Hi, this is Leonard Lopate. You're listening to WNYC On Demand. Podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads available when you want to listen at WNYC.org and iTunes.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed Hosting Services, providing application management, hosting, professional services, security services, and compliance solutions for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
James Gustav Speth has been a major figure in the field of environmentalism for over 30 years. That has led Time magazine to dub him the ultimate insider. He is the dean of the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale University, the co-founder of the Natural Resources Defense Council, and former White House environmental advisor to Jimmy Carter. In his latest book, The Bridge at the Edge of the World, Professor Speth presents evidence as to why American-style consumer capitalism is to blame for the increasingly dismal state of our planet. His book is published by Yale Books, and I'm pleased that it has brought James Gustav Speth back to the show today. Hello.
Hi, Lynn. Delighted to be back.
You've written three previous books on this topic. Your last one, Red Sky at Morning, America and the Crisis of the Global Environment, received a lot of attention. What's different about this one?
Well, what I try to do in this book is address a paradox, really. We do have this paradox. The environmental community in our country has gotten stronger and more sophisticated over now, you know, close to four decades, and yet here we find ourselves on the brink of ruining the planet. Now, how do we have to come to terms with that. We have to deeply understand how we got ourselves into this situation where the trends are so threatening at this point, despite the fact that we've built up this major cause, this major concern in our country. And the book sets out to do that and to try to identify what we can do about it.
In the preface, you write that you find it impossible to be happy with the results of your 30-year-long career. So, obviously, you're less optimistic here than you were in the other books.
Well, I think the more I looked at the information, the data that we have about environmental conditions and trends, both globally and within our own country, the more concerned I got. And I really wrote the book because I came to the conclusion that we're on a path to unprecedented environmental decline, and that the current type of environmentalism that we have puts off limits so many of the things that we now need to do to address the problem. It's a very particular type of environmentalism that we have today, and I don't think it's up to the job.
What do you say to the global warming naysayers like Václav Klaus, the president of the Czech Republic, who has questioned Al Gore's sanity and said global warming is a false myth? I don't know whether any myth is anything but false. But anyway, he said it's a false myth, and every serious person and scientist says so.
Well, Václav Havel, one of his predecessors, I think, had better judgment. This is, I think, no longer a serious issue. We should pray that the naysayers are right. Unfortunately, we have now just an overwhelming environmental consensus that this is a real problem, that it's coming at us very fast, and indeed it's coming at us faster than the latest report of this Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, our major international effort to examine the problem, said it was, and we're on the verge of moving into a regime, into a planetary situation where we've created so much warming that the warming becomes self-sustaining and self-increasing and self-reinforcing, and that is enormously disturbing.
Yesterday was the 38th annual Earth Day. Were people thinking along these lines when the first one was created in 1970?
Well, I think in 1970 we had a group of issues, strip mining, clear cutting, air pollution, water pollution, that were very local in a sense. They were in people's faces. They were in your backyard, in your neighborhood. But a decade later, around 1980, we came to see that there were this set of global-scale environmental threats, including climate change, in 1980.
And then when the report Global 2000 came out.
We did the Global 2000 report in the Carter administration. We sort of projected what would happen if governments didn't respond to these global scale threats by the year 2000. And lo and behold, by the year 2000, they really had not responded. And we had lost an acre or a second of tropical forest. The greenhouse gases had continued to build up in the atmosphere. But we put out three reports in the Carter administration calling for strong government action to curb greenhouse gas emissions. Now, that was, you know, almost 30 years ago now. And for 30 years, we've neglected this problem, and we've run out of time. The slack that nature gave us is gone.
Well, why did no one respond during those years? It was because Jimmy Carter was... at that point, so vulnerable that he couldn't get much through Congress on anything?
Well, I was looking at a New York Times story that reporting on one of our reports in the Carter administration, and it was dated January 1981, which was our last month in office at that time. So I think losing Carter was a great loss. If we'd had a second term, he would have taken up these issues, I'm sure, but we began to lose time right there. But the real, you know, the global warming issue is hard. It's a hard issue to get your head around, for people to get their heads around. And there's been during that period, there was a tremendous amount of disinformation spread about. And a lot of, I would say, fairly fake contestation of the science that was a lot of it sponsored by folks like Exxon and others. But I also think that we can't blame the whole neglect on that, because even today's polls, after Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth, after the cover stories on every magazine, I bet you've done stories on this, your segments on this yourself. Even then, even today, the Gallup poll that they do every Earth Day came out yesterday and showed that while something like 60 or 70% of the public recognizes this is a serious issue, it is down at the bottom of the list of environmental concerns. Astoundingly, global warming is at the bottom of the list of environmental concerns.
I can also tell you that I will get at least one or two emails from people who tell me that this is a false issue. I get emails regularly from various groups that suggest that it's not true. James Imhoff in the Senate is just one of many voices on the national level who say this is not true. And there was a group. There was a meeting, I guess, a couple of months back here in New York City.
Meeting.
Yeah, in which with taking out full pages of the New York Times, in which they said that global warming is a myth. Yes, we do have something. We do have some climate change, but this is just part of the natural process of Earth.
Well, would that they were right, because my greatest concern right now is that the best science we have, and it is overwhelmingly on this side, is telling us that we face a situation where we could see devastating changes. We could really, truly ruin the planet and that the time that we have to begin to put in place measures to, you know, to begin to reduce the emissions of these gases and to start reducing them very sharply is vanishingly small now.
My guest is James Gustav Speth, who is Dean of the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale University. His latest book, The Bridge at the Edge of the World, Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability, published by Yale University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Has your definition of environmentalism changed since the first Earth Day or over the years?
Well, not really. I think you can think of today's environmentalism as a group of tactics, so to speak, that involve raising issues, developing and presenting proposals for dealing with those issues, lobbying the legislatures of our land to get action, and litigating when the agencies don't implement the legislation. And that's been what we've been doing for 40 years now. And And it works up to a point. I shudder to think what the planet would look like without that. But the bottom line is that things have continued to go downhill across a wide front, whether you look at the warming issue, the loss of forests, fresh waters, the devastation of fisheries, the loss of wetlands, spreading desert-like conditions, a loss to the corals. You know, we're driving species extinct 1,000 times the rate that they normally go extinct, and then all the toxics accumulating in our environment. These things have gotten worse, by and large.
Are there any exceptions to the notion that all global threats have only worsened?
Well, the one success story in the global area is the efforts that have been put in place to protect the loss of the stratospheric ozone shield. That was caused by the spray cans and the chlorofluorocarbons, and we've done a pretty good job internationally of taking those dangerous chemicals out of commerce, and hopefully the ozone shield will recover. But these other global scale problems have continued to go downhill. Domestically, you know, there is better air and better water now, but it's really amazing that after, you know, 40 years of the strictest laws on the books in air and water, a third of Americans still live in counties with unhealthy air. Half of our lakes and a third of our streams still fail to meet the EPA standards. What is happening is...
And now we're finding out that we have pharmaceuticals in our water, things that would have nothing to do with any of these efforts. But they're scary on another level.
Well, they're pharmaceuticals. They're also endocrine-disrupting substances, the so-called gender-bender chemicals. And the Congress got very concerned when two of the major tributaries of the Potomac, they did samples of the bass fish, of the male bass fish in both of these tributaries, and in 80% of the fish found eggs. So Congress got very concerned. This is the drinking water of the of our Congress, and so maybe we'll get some more attention on these issues. But the truth is, what is happening is that we live in a system that will not let the type of environmentalism that we're trying today succeed in a major way. And my conclusion in the book is that if we want to succeed, we're going to have to change the system.
Now, the system, as your subtitle suggests, is capitalism. Capitalism is pretty much the system right now for everybody. Even the countries that call themselves communist right now are engaged in some form of capitalism. Is there an alternative method of governing that you're suggesting?
Along various dimensions, I think there is. I certainly am not a socialist, and I don't think the answer is to socialize the means of production. But I do think we need to search for a non-socialist alternative to today's capitalism. What we have is we live and we work in an economic system that's enormously destructive of the environment. It's driven by profit motives because it really cares mostly about profit and investing a large share of those profits and growing. Growth is almost inherently destructive of environment. We have very little evidence of it, that to the contrary. And the profit motive pushes firms to externalize their environmental costs, to keep the cost of their environmental damage off their books so they can continue to profit. So in effect, we're deeply subsidizing, the environment is deeply subsidizing the profitability of companies today. One result of that is that prices of things that destroy the environment are artificially low. And so we have this now gigantic machine, and I want to come back to that in a second, this gigantic machine that is guided primarily by market signals, prices, and those prices are environmentally dishonest. And so this juggernaut is rolling forward seriously out of control in an environmental sense.
Well, the president says that he is concerned about the environment, but he doesn't want to do anything that will hurt business and the development of things that will affect our future.
Well, this is one of the things I think we have to challenge. The book goes into several things that I think we have to begin to challenge. When Bush wanted to depart from the Kyoto Protocol and reject it internationally, he merely said it will hurt the economy. And that was, you know, for enough people, certainly him, enough of an argument. But the truth is, that we have not been, we've been growing tremendously, but it's not been making us any better off. We've had a long-term recession in the quality of life in our country, and this growth is not being put to good use. And in a way, it's deflecting us from doing the things that we need to be attending to. And it's enormously environmentally destructive. So I think we've got to challenge growth. We've got to look at what it would mean to go to a post-growth society where we were concentrating on building the things that really mattered and not sacrificing our environment, our communities, ourselves, our own psychology, to the goal of ever more aggregate mere GDP expansion.
I remember a former cabinet member, James Watt, saying when he was asked about the environment and the danger for the future. This was a long time ago when James Watt was in the White House. He said, well, we're living in the last days, talking about biblical prophecies, and so it doesn't really matter.
Well, it matters so much. I was just with my grandchildren and thinking about them and where the trends are leading, and it matters so very much what we do today. Beyond this look at growth, Lynn, and this challenge to growth and asking ourselves whether it really benefits us or whether what we have in fact is uneconomic growth. Beyond that challenge to growth, I think we need to challenge the way corporations are chartered and set up. We need to challenge our own consumerism, our own pathetic capitulation to consumerism. And we need to deal with the enormous social insecurity of most people in our country. We will never deal successfully with these environmental conditions when we have, poverty rates at an all-time high, inequality at an all-time high, and most people in the country living on modest incomes, nickel and dime to death, tremendous insecurity among our people. We've got to deal with the social issue and the environmental issue together.
My guest is James Gustav Speth, who is Dean of the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale University. His book, The Bridge at the Edge of the World, Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability, published by Yale University Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with James Gustav Speth, whose latest book is The Bridge at the Edge of the World, Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability, published by Yale University Press. We've been talking about the United States and our system, but isn't this a global problem? I mean, we've heard a lot about China and its polluting, its serious problem with pollution. And we have talked with environmentalists from Brazil on this show about what's going on in the Amazon and how it has changed the weather patterns of South America, and especially of the Amazon. The Amazon has been called the lungs of the earth.
Well, Lynn, I think you're absolutely right that these are global issues, and I think, but we need to look at things in pieces. My book talks about the rich countries, the affluent countries, and here it's extraordinarily important that we begin to set a different example for the world. It's also extraordinarily important that we get a lot more engaged in promoting things like an energy transition in China and India away from the path that they are on, in promoting things like a huge increase in our assistance for population programs internationally. And the United States, the Senate is a graveyard for international treaties. I could rattle on for a long time on all the environmental and social and other and political agreements that have been reached, which the United States has never ratified.
This predates the Bush administration. In fact, the Kyoto Protocol were signed during the Clinton years, and he knew that it was never going to get past Congress.
That's true. It goes back a long time. There's this national arrogance, I'm afraid, and unwillingness to, sort of a national superiority complex that we don't have to play ball with the rest of the world. Is very unfortunate. But the list of environmental conventions that we haven't agreed to is quite long, including the Law of the Sea and the Biodiversity Convention and the Toxic Chemicals Regulation and others, not to mention the Kyoto Protocol on climate. There needs to be a lot done now to engage with China and India on the climate issue. This is extraordinarily serious. The Chinese greenhouse gas emissions now exceed ours slightly, so we're number one and number two, and they're unlikely to do the right thing, though, until we do the right thing and until we create powerful incentives. The Chinese have basically proposed that the international community effectively double foreign aid, international development assistance, and put that extra doubling into assisting them and others into an energy transition away from the path that they are on. And, frankly, we can't expect them to do what I think we should be doing, which is challenging growth because they are still poor. But the rich among us need to take stock. Are we really doing the things that make our lives better? Are we really, doing the things that lead to human fulfillment? Or are we caught in this consumerist treadmill, just buying and buying, materialism is toxic to happiness.
Can you imagine anyone in Congress or any future president saying, yes, we'll give money to China to clean up their act? China right now is one of the fastest growing economies in the world. If anything, we are incredibly indebted to China right now.
Well, we certainly are, but we're going to have to create powerful international incentives through the World Bank and other institutions to promote the energy transition away from carbon-intensive technologies. I don't think there's any alternative to that. Of course, the Chinese will have to spend a lot of their own resources in that regard. I think the proposals I make in the book for restructuring the way we govern corporations, taking on consumerism, trying to basically reclaim our failing weak democracy and challenging growth and these types of things. These are not things that are going to happen easily. And I think one of the things I talk about in the book is what are some circumstances which could make these almost impossible seeming objectives become plausible.
And like, you mean like challenging our society's obsession with materialism and growth?
Yes, exactly. I think there is a, I think you can envision a scenario in which, these seemingly far-fetched things become very realistic. And one thing that could drive that, of course, is some type of crisis. If you have and if we don't change course, we will see a crisis or more of many types of crises, I'm afraid. And coming up first out of the climate change issue, I would speculate. If there's a sense of emerging crisis and it occurs at a time of wise leadership, which we haven't had, and the leaders can help people understand, can draw on the best of our values and point us in the new directions that we need to go. And if that is coming at a time also where there's a strong social movement in our country developing, and we are using what we know about promoting change through the media, through advertising and other things like the ads that Al Gore is now running on the climate issue. If all of these things come together, we could see, I think, a major change in our country. It won't happen right away, but that's the scenario that I think is a hopeful one.
A caller wants to know if reframing the cause as a humanitarian issue as opposed to an environmental one might inspire more people to act up.
Well, I do that in the book to a considerable degree, because I think that the issues of social justice in our country are very severe, and that what is going on is that we have a system that is committed overwhelmingly to profits, to reinvesting them, to growth, and that's what it really cares about. And it's up to us as citizens to use our government to inject human values for social justice and natural values for the protection of our only habitat into that system. And what's happening now is that we're failing to inject those values successfully because our politics are too enfeebled, and increasingly corporations, vested interests, are our main political actors, not people. So corporations are not just the most powerful economic actors in our system, they're now the most powerful political actors in our system. So we need to build enormous new political strength. And what I call for in the book is really a movement that brings together those who are concerned about environment, with those who are deeply concerned about social justice issues, with those who are deeply concerned about the erosion of our democracy and the loss of popular control. And if we can achieve a fusion of these different communities, which today hardly speak, and bring that together as one cause, one inseparable cause, I think we might make it.
Is there a hierarchy of environmental problems, or are they equally urgent?
Well, the climate issue has got to be at the top because it affects everything else, and it's now gotten to the point where it's truly urgent.
You mean the melting of the ice,
well,
for example?
For example, we just lost another huge hunk of the Antarctic Peninsula, the state-size piece of ice shelf falling off. That's the second one of those. There's unpredicted unanticipated movement of glacial ice on Greenland. And, you know, between
and most of the many of the mountaintops no longer have snow caps of the sort that they did.
Well, glaciers essentially everywhere are disappearing. And, you know, and it's not just, we won't see glaciers anymore up there. What happens, of course, is that those glaciers regulate the melt, the runoff, into so many of the highly populated, densely populated parts of the world, where they provide, you know, the summer growing season, water for the growing season. And when you lose those glaciers, it's going to change fundamentally the capacity of these areas to grow crops.
My guest is James Gustav Speth. His latest book, The Bridge at the Edge of the World, Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability, published by Yale University Press. There was an article, a major article in today's New York Times, about European countries moving back to coal as a source of energy. The Europeans have been much more conscious of environmentalism than people in this country have been. Do you see this as a backward step?
Well, were it to occur, it would be devastating, a hugely backward step. We in the U.S. have, you know, it wasn't that long ago, there were about 150 coal-fired power plants proposed. And, you know, thank goodness for our environmental organizations. They went out and started challenging these plants in the U.S., and I think about half of them have now been slowed up. The governor of Kansas is a real heroine, in my view, by striking down the proposal to build these plants there. If Europe is going in that direction, it's a tremendously a backward step and a very bad sign. I hope that somebody's just shooting across the bow, trying to alert people to this before it really becomes a trend.
Well, they have tried to use solar energy, wind energy. Their nuclear energy has been used in Europe. All of them have problems.
Well, nothing's perfect, but we need to move to really precision energy use. We're wasting so much energy throughout our economy today. That's the first big thing to do. But wind has taken off. They're now equivalent of about 100 big nuclear power plants in wind. The wind energy capacity is now equal to about 100 large nuclear power plants globally, and it's growing fast. And the U.S. is now one of the fastest-growing places for wind energy. So there's a great future there. Solar prices are coming down sharply. There are new technologies that are being explored. We're building our building at our new home for our school, the Environment School at Yale. It will have solar cells on the roof, ground source heat pump going down under the building, and we've eliminated, through the design of the building, about two-thirds of the normal energy use in a modern building, and we tend to use renewable energy for the remaining third and be carbon neutral. And
would you like to see laws enacted that forced people to build that way?
Well, we actually have these laws coming. They're on many states now, including New York and New Jersey and Connecticut, all have what's called a renewable energy portfolio standard, where the utilities in the state are required to shift to a certain proportion, sometimes 15, sometimes 25% of their power production to renewable sources. So it is being driven by government. Government is absolutely essential in this process. People who think we need government to effectuate the goals that will protect us and our children and our grandchildren, and this whole idea that somehow we're going to get through the period that we're in with minimalist government, is as crazy as thinking that we can make our people secure around the world without government.
A listener wanted to know your thoughts about so-called green capitalism.
Well, we've waited a long time to see companies pick up the environmental banner, and I think they're doing it now in an unprecedented way. But is it enough? So it's good to see. We've waited a long time for it, and I really applaud it. But it's at the margin of what needs to happen. It won't. All the green consumer interest and the greening of corporation behavior, it will make a difference, but it won't make a very big difference, in my judgment. The system, in the end, has got to grow. It's got to make huge profits, and is very competitive unless these changes, the only reliable green company is one that's required to be so by law.
Well, we've seen the development of green consumerism, but I have a feeling that it's only making a teeny dent in this huge problem.
Well,
I bring a canvas bag to the supermarket, for example,
it's tremendously overdone. There was a group that examined the green claims of slightly over 1,000 products and found that only a few of them were completely honest and completely, met all the what you would expect, really, the standards.
You used to work for the UN, and a number of listeners are interested in knowing about the effect of population growth on the planet and its impact on the environment.
Well, it's a huge driver of environmental deterioration in particular localities and overall. We're 6.5 billion people now. We could easily go beyond 9. We need major international programs to help countries reduce their fertility rates, maternal and child health care, reproductive health services, jobs for women, education for girls. These are the things that really make a difference. And we've got to learn in the U.S. what we need to do about our population issue. I remember back in the 70s, there was the Stop It 2 movement, and my wife and I pledged that we would stop it too, and then we had our third child. But we've got to bring back this concern about our own population growth. We're the third most populous country, and our population is growing.
Now, we have no time left, but I just have to ask you, is it possible to reverse this?
Yes, it's possible, and reverse we need to affect some major transformations in our society, or we are going to ruin our planet. And we simply cannot let that happen.
And you lay some of those out in this book, which is called The Bridge at the Edge of the World, Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability. My great thanks to James Gustav Speth of Yale for being our guest today.
Thank you, Lynn.
The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Tess Hartman, Dina Mann, and Samantha Morgenstern. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to WNYC On Demand. Please check out the other programs at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This is a free service made available by our listeners. Become a member of WNYC today.